Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Suddenly, it's socialism versus capitalism. Trash talk about the Marxism of Ed Miliband's father has framed a conference season that has been startlingly ideological. Red Ed says that he wants to bring socialism back and freeze your fuel bills. David Cameron wants to build an aspiration nation and kick youngsters off welfare. So who won the fight, and will the voters notice? I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's Sue Cameron, Peter Oborne, and Benedict Brogan. When Ed Miliband arrived in Brighton for his conference, he was asked by a punter, "Are you going to bring socialism back?" And the Edster replied, "That's what we're doing, sir." It looks like he meant it. In his conference speech, Red Ed threw away years of New Labour centrism and launched into an attack on the big fuel companies, the bedroom tax, and Tory greed. Make no mistake, if he wins the next election, then the government will get a whole lot bigger, big enough to freeze prices and seize unused private land. This leftward swing gave David Cameron the chance to fill the centre ground, and he did so with aplomb. He wants to build an aspiration nation full of enterprise and ambition that doesn't leave anyone behind. So now the battle has become socialism versus capitalism, made all the more rancorous by the intervention of the Daily Mail, which published an article accusing Ed's Marxist father, Ralph, of hating his country. Toto, we are no longer in Kansas. We are now in Britain in about 1974. I'd like to start by getting everyone's take on how the conference season played out for the leaders. Peter, who do you think had the best conference?
There are four main political parties in Britain now. And I think Nigel Farage, who's his conference was blown off course. But the other three parties, I think all three of them had very good conferences. Clegg, I was anticipating more turbulence, and he's emerged as an unchallenged Lib Dem leader. Miliband had a fantastic conference because he had real potential challenges from his own party. For the first time, it was looking possible he might be dislodged as leader. He made a very interesting speech. He won back party support, and he has been given an enormous boost by this row about his father. And Cameron had a good conference. It was a Tory party conference. It was very well arranged, it was well managed, and Cameron's speech was superb.
So they all had a good one, but they were all sort of playing to archetypes of what their politics is. None of them had a conference which necessarily broke our expectations of them.
Look, I challenge that proposition that it's a very dated notion that parties should break with their archetypes. That's the modernising proposition of the late 90s, is the Clinton-esque triangulation. And what was lovely about this conference season is that we moved away from this proposition that political parties ought to be counterintuitive, and you found them going back to their own natures. And I think that Miliband primarily deserves the credit for that, because his speech, you know, was a tribute to the Labour Party, was a sort of rediscovering its soul after 20 years of losing it. And I think that I thought Cameron's speech was actually a masterpiece, to be honest, the way he expressed basic Tory philosophy.
Okay. Benedict Brogan, do you agree?
Well, for my money, the winner of the conference season is British politics generally, because what we've managed to do is finally get rid of the kind of Blairite centrist groupthink that has dominated politics for the last 20 years, the blancmange of centrism and consensus, which has been so stifling of politics, has finally been scraped off the plate and chucked in the bin, and that is a good thing. We finally have a proper cleavage in politics. We have separation and distinction. Labour has gone off on its leftly trend that Ed Miliband is pursuing, and the Conservatives have sounded conservative and clear, and the Lib Dems, even to Nick Clegg's credit, at least we now have an idea of what the Lib Dems are for, which is staying in power at whatever cost.
Yeah.
So from the point of view of British politics, it has been the most helpful 3 weeks I could imagine.
But what's interesting is that that's come from the leaders of the parties. You know, Peter, you were saying they've sort of gone back a bit to the heart and soul of the parties as they were in the past. But that was because the parties used to have strong grassroots, whereas this is the leaders deciding, I want my party to be like this. It's not like the old conferences.
Which adds to the flavour of originality for it. They're not being led by their parties. They are stamping their own distinctive personalities on them. Given that for a while we thought they were three 40-something blokes from privileged backgrounds who were all much of a muchness, they have at least shown a bit of leadership and shown some clear identity. I think the ones who have come out of that best, I think, is Ed Miliband, who clearly is the one who set the agenda for the conference season with his speech. But equally, David Cameron, in his way, picked up that gauntlet that was thrown down by Ed Miliband and came up with an answer that was, for my money, compelling and intellectually coherent. And Nick Clegg, the guy who we had been used to writing off as the ultimate loser in British politics, who had no future and was destined for the knacker's yard, even he managed to make an argument for what was the point of the Lib Dems and what was the point of his leadership.
Sue Cameron, were you excited by the conferences?
I wouldn't say I was excited as such, but I think I'm excited by the outcome. I absolutely agree with Ben that British politics has almost certainly been the gainer. I think you mentioned the grassroots, by the way. Well, hardly any parties have got any grassroots to speak of,
no.
So they're all dying on their feet. But I thought one of the important things, clearly battle lines for the next election are now up and running, but one of the things that it seems to me is going to happen is that politics is now becoming much more polarised. You could see it in 1970s terms, though I don't think it'll play out quite like that, but there's a strong flavour of that. And when politics is very polarised, it tends to do two things. One is you get a higher turnout, which has been dropping like a stone. I mean, it was 65%, something like two-thirds last time when you have a general election. The other thing that happens, and this is one good piece of news for the Tories, or should be, is that the smaller, not for Nick Clegg, but the smaller parties get squeezed.
Exactly.
Because yeah. It's the head-to-head of the two big beasts. And I think that's what we are going to see very strongly. And I think that will make for a much more exciting period. And I think, as I think Peter said, there's going to be big questions about the role of the state, the size of the state, and these are really, really important.
Is UKIP suddenly irrelevant?
No.
No.
No, I don't underestimate Farage.
Peter?
Not at all. No, I think they're still a phenomenally interesting and powerful force. Although I did think that they had a setback in this conference season, and partly for the... And if the other main parties can make themselves more authentic, then UKIP becomes less... The protest vote becomes less powerful. I want to challenge, by the way, the notion that your language at the very beginning of all of this, when you said that, you know, we're going back to socialism and the 70s, there's very flimsy evidence yet that Miliband has really done this. I mean, what we've had really is this fuel price freeze, which is... I mean, there's a big difference between a fuel price freeze and the mass nationalisation, etc., of the Attlee administration.
Yeah.
And you were a little bit loose, I felt, when you said, you know, the food prices being frozen. It's just fuel.
Oh, I didn't say food. I only said fuel.
That's not what I wrote down.
Okay.
But
before we get on to that, Ben, very quickly on the political point about UKIP, because I saw you waving at me.
I think UKIP is a souffle that is going to gradually deflate as
good
time passes.
Segue. That's perfect.
Why? Because the more vigorous the main parties are being in establishing their own individual identities, the more Labour strikes out as being what we understand as traditional Labour, the more the division between the two main parties becomes clear, the more the choice is clear. And I think those of a conservative bent who previously had been drawn to UKIP in part by the just sheer boring beigeness of both the Conservatives and Labour are going to start coming back. I think also the fact is that UKIP, when it comes under scrutiny, is going to struggle, as it found it did at its conference. And while it will have a good moment at the European elections next spring, and that'll be a difficult moment for the Conservatives, I think in terms of where we get to in 2015, I suspect that UKIP will fall away.
Exactly. And all that basically happened was that UKIP did come under scrutiny, and as soon as someone actually Googled some of the names involved, they found all sorts of horrors hidden. Can you respond to Peter's point about Ed's socialism then? Let's move on to that. Just how socialist really is this programme? Are we over-egging it a bit?
Peter's absolutely right that relative to the socialism that Britain experienced under Attlee or even under Labour in the 60s and 70s, this is fairly light pink socialism. But we must remember that for the last 20 years or so, and certainly in the minds of those who now talk about politics and who invest social media and the blogosphere and who talk about what is going on in British politics at the moment, what Ed Miliband did last week is actually quite unfamiliar and quite startling. And I suspect that's why everybody is slightly shocked by the vehemence of the media coverage of Ed Miliband, that we have almost suffering from collective amnesia of what the political divisions were like up until 1979, or certainly up until even 1994, when Tony Blair took the Labour Party and turned it into a sort of soft conservative operation. The fact is that Ed Miliband may not be a socialist in the sense of his forebears, but in terms of the current state of British politics, he has just suddenly lunged to the left.
Yeah. Sue?
I absolutely agree with that, but I think that there is perhaps a risk of trying to paint Red Ed as this sort of socialist from the 70s, you know, and we'll be back to the dead unburied and the rubbish uncollected. And most people don't, a lot of voters don't remember that, so it's not that meaningful to them. But the other thing is, which is much more difficult for the Tories, and I think we've already seen this, is that I think the line that Labour is going to take, they're not going to bang on about we're sort of socialists so much as we are going to be, they are going to say they are for fairness, they are going to say that they are going to be on the side of ordinary people, of the little man against the big energy companies, the big yeah. bankers, and I think that will be a lot harder. And I think, although we in the bubble might say, well, some of the things that Ed's been talking about, you know, state control of prices is economically illiterate, I think to a lot of people it will have resonance, because they will say he's talking about my cost of living. Yes, yeah. I'm with him. I think the Tories have to respond to that, and indeed we're beginning to see them doing it.
Yeah, I'm very suspicious, actually, of the way this debate is being framed. Ed has lurched to the left and Cameron has gone into the centre ground. This is a very conservative narrative. I mean, that could be what you would say. If you were a Labour person, which I'm not, but you could make an equally plausible case that Ed has stayed in the centre ground and Cameron has gone off to the right. Think about that passage which he about corporate profits, because big companies, we mustn't tax them out of existence, from Cameron. You know, I noticed the complete lack of revulsion at the fact that Amazon doesn't pay any tax. You know, I'd have liked a bit of that. And Cameron, because he saw this opportunity to become the party of enterprise, brings with it quite a lot of baggage. You could argue that Cameron has gone off the right. I mean, what is clearly the case is that all of this is up for dispute. There's going to be a lot of technical argument now about whether the fuel price thing can work. You claimed in your intro that there's some sort of land grab going on. That's a Tory line.
Yeah.
Is there really? Yeah. And I'm not sure really there is.
Well, it's a principle, isn't it? It's the idea that if a private owner of land is not using it in a way that the state approves of, then the state has the right to seize it.
Here is Sue Cameron. She's much more learned.
I'm not learned. But I have read in the last 24 hours that Boris Johnson at one point made a speech saying, we are going to seize land hasn't been built on.
But what we're really assessing is what it is that the parties and their leaders are promising to do were they in power after 2015. And we have to go by what they say. And if Ed Miliband is going to throw around sentences such as use it or lose it, people, I think, are entitled to infer that there might be something a bit distasteful to the right and something a bit red in tooth and claw about it.
And something quite risky. I mean, the freezing fuel prices is actually quite economically risky.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not? Because it's going to affect stock prices, it's going to affect their willingness to invest. They're going to think, I'm not going to make a profit in those 2 years.
Well, the counter to that is that it is something that chimes enormously with what the British public are thinking about. I think the danger for the Conservatives is that it's all well and good for them to turn on Labour and start talking about going back to the bad old days of socialism, but I think one of the reasons why the Conservatives have been quite cautious in how they've responded to Ed Miliband is that they are well aware that one of the things that Ed Miliband has done that is very clever is that he has aligned himself with a widespread sense of public disgust and anger and disappointment that throughout the depths of this terrible recession, the rich have got richer and have avoided any pain, and the big companies, the big energy companies, the banks, have continued to gouge them in their pocketbooks. And so one of the plays of Ed Miliband is that he is aligning himself with the little guy, and the Tories are desperately nervous as to whether or not that might actually work for Labour.
But of course, as we all know, as good, intelligent Conservatives, you need a healthy business climate. You need people to feel they can afford to invest. I mean, it's true there may well be electoral advantage in this, but it's not good for the economy.
Two aren't necessarily incompatible. I mean, I think one of the things that Miliband is tapping into is the sense of, as Peter mentioned, the unfairness. You know, Google, I mean, has been paying about threepence halfpenny tax. The banks we all know about, you know, the bankers' bonuses. And this government, so far, and for all sorts of reasons that are understandable, hasn't taken them on. It's not been seen to take them on. It's outsourced it to Andrew Tyrie, banking commission, for example. And I think, and of course you're right that you've got to have a climate where people are attracted to invest, but that doesn't mean that you can then say, well, in order to invest, you can do whatever you like, which is the sense that a lot of people have, and the people, the ordinary people, get it in the neck.
The difficulty for the Conservatives is that their answers to Ed Miliband are quite abstract, are quite academic, are quite technical about how an economy can be harmed if prices are controlled, about how an economy doesn't grow if businesses are prevented from expanding and making profits. Explain that to a family which has only one earner who's on £25,000 and struggles to meet the bills by the end of the month, and they will look at you in disbelief, and they will perhaps be more minded to listen to Ed Miliband when he says, well, you know what, I'm going to stick it to those energy companies on your behalf.
By the way, I mean, again, I just look at a historical perspective. That rabid socialist, Maggie Thatcher, the first thing she did when she became in government was impose a whacking great windfall tax on the energy companies.
Yeah.
And so
she was a good politician.
Yeah. But that's about being flexible within the framework of a broad philosophy. I mean, you can get away with things like that if you've got a general course which people understand that you're set on. You can take risks that way. One of the problems with David Cameron, perhaps, is that he's not laid out what his course is until now.
But now that he has, it means it's clear. And people, I think, one of the things that they will have noticed with David Cameron this week is that he actually spoke quietly and quite modestly and quite realistically about what it is that he is capable of doing and what the limits are on what he can do. And that is actually what is going to help Cameron answer Ed Miliband, is that he can present himself as a calm, no-nonsense steward who is seeking to get the economy out of the mess it's in, rather than trying to match Ed Miliband's rhetoric with his own sort of version of a right-wing Ed.
Peter. Okay, one other thing about the conference. The most important thing about the conference in terms of high politics was Cameron saying it was OK for Boris Johnson to stand as an MP in the 2015 election. So it's OK, says the Prime Minister, for Cameron to let down the London voters, to have a part-time mayor. That smacks to me of a deal. It smacks to me that Boris is now going to be let in by the Conservative Party. They'll find him a safe seat. And that means, of course, that Boris Johnson will be there to challenge Cameron for the leadership at any point after 2015. But in terms of high politics, that's completely fascinating.
Finally, how relevant is it? And I don't necessarily want to get into conversation about muckraking, but how relevant is it to a politician's career, the politics of their father? Does it matter? Is there any link between Ed Miliband's move to the left and his father's Marxism? Is it something that the voters should consider?
I think it's something that they're bound to consider after the rows that we've had over the last week. And of course, if you're looking at a leading politician, of course the influence of their parents or of those around them are indeed fascinating. But this has come rather out of the blue to attack somebody because of what, I mean, I know the sins of the fathers are visited, etc., etc., but to attack somebody because of their father's politics and arguably to attack them them in a way that's possibly very unfair. I mean, there were an awful lot of people, British-born people, particularly in the 20s and 30s, that generation, who for all sorts of very understandable reasons hated the capitalist system and were much more inclined to be left-wingers of one kind or another. And I think that the net result is that it will have won Ed Miliband a great deal of sympathy from people who think this is unfair, this is an attempt to bully him, it's below the belt.
Peter, do you agree with that?
Add to that that there is something visceral about defending your dad.
Yeah.
Somebody has pointed out that up to now, Ed Miliband seemed by the voters as somebody who knifed his brother. Now he's a bloke who came to the defence of his dad. And everybody knows, we come to the, you know, however awful one's father might be, we stand up for one's dad. I think that's a big, big thing for Miliband.
Ed Miliband has seized an unexpected opportunity to reinforce the message that he's willing to stand up to the big guys who challenge Labour. From that point of view, he's been quite astute at the way he's done it. There is something very emotive about standing up for one's father. But it is certainly the case that it is completely legitimate to debate and inquire and look at the influences on any political leader. That is completely normal. Yep. And I think the one thing we should also remind ourselves is that this kind of debate about ideology and about the formative experiences on politicians is one that was very familiar to us 20 or 30 years ago. And I think the anemic politics of the last 20 years mean that we are no longer used to this level of kind of life or death scrutiny around big ideological issues. And that, I think, partly explains the reaction, that people have got out of the habit of understanding that some of these issues do matter and are worth arguing over.
Benedict Brogan, Sue Cameron and Peter Oborne, thank you all very much.